flowers of the abyss. I must whisper my words in the wind, knowing somehow that they will reach you who sent me here. Let this misadventure, like the first rank scent of autumn, be carried back to you, my good people. For it was you who decided where I would go, you who wished I come here and to him. And I agreed, because the fear that filled your voices and lined your faces was so much greater than your words could explain. I feared your fear of him, the one whose name we did not know, the one who lived far from town in that ruined house which long ago had seen the passing of the family Van Liven. What a tragedy, we all agreed. And they kept that beautiful garden for so long. But he doesn't seem much interested in such things. I was chosen to unravel his secrets and find what malice or indifference the new owner harbored toward our town. I should be the one, you said. Was I not the teacher of the town's child citizens, the one who had knowledge that you had not, and who might therefore see deeper into the mystery of our man? That was what you said, in the shadows of our church where we met that night. But what you thought, I could not help but sense, was that he has no children of his own, no one, and so many of his hours are spent walking through those same woods in which lives the stranger. It would seem quite natural if I happened to pass the old Van Liven house, if I happened to stop and perhaps beg a glass of water for a thirsty walker of the woods. But these simple actions, even then, seemed an extraordinary adventure, though none of us confessed to this feeling. Nothing to fear, you said. And so I was chosen to go alone to that house which had fallen into such disrepair. You have seen the house, and how, approaching it from the road that leads out of town, it sprouts suddenly into view, a pale flower amid the dark summer trees, now a ghostly flower at autumn. At first, this is how it appeared to my eyes. Yes, my eyes. Think about them, good people. Dream about them. But as I neared the house, its grayish planks, bowed and buckled and oddly spotted, turned the pallid lily to a pulpy toadstool. Surely the house has played this trick on some of you, and all of you have seen it at one time or another. Its roof of rippling shingles, shaped like scales from some great fish, sea green and sparkling in the autumn sun. Its two attic gables with paned windows that come to a point like the tip of a tier. Its sepulcher-shaped doorway at the top of rotted wooden stairs. And as I stood among the shadows outside that door, I heard hundreds of raindrops running up the steps behind me as the air went cold and the skies gained shadows of their own. The light rain spotted the empty ashen plot nearby the house, watering the barren ground where that remarkable garden had blossomed in the time of the Van Livens. What better excuse for my imposing upon the present owner of this house? Shelter me, stranger, from the icy autumn storm and from a fragrance damp and decayed. He responded promptly to my rapping, without suspicious movements of the ragged curtains, and I entered his dark home. There was no need for explanation. He had already seen me walking ahead of the clouds, though I had not seen him. His lanky limbs like vaguely twisted branches, his lazy, expressionless face, the colorless rags which are easier to see as tattered wrappings than as parts of even the poorest wardrobe. But his voice, that is something none of you has ever heard. Although shaken at how gentle and musical it sounded, I was even less prepared for the sense of great distances created by the echo of his hollow words.
It was just such a day as this when I saw you for the first time walking in the woods, he said, looking out at the rain. But you did not come near to the house. I wondered if you ever would.
His words put me at ease, for our introduction to each other appeared to have already been made. I removed my coat, which he took and placed on a very small wooden chair beside the front door, extending a long, crooked arm and wide hand toward the interior. He formally welcomed me into his home. But somehow he himself did not seem at home there. It was as if the Van Leeuwen family had left all their worldly goods behind them for the use of the next occupant of their house, which would not be peculiar, tragedy considered. Nothing seemed to belong to him, though there was little enough in that house to be possessed by anyone. Apart from the two old chairs in which we sat down, and the tiny misshapen table between them, the few other objects I could see appeared to have been brought together only by accident or default, a sign of the last days of the Van Leeuwens. A huge trunk lying in the corner, its great tarnished lock sprung open, and its heavy straps falling loosely to the floor would have looked much less sullen, buried away in an attic or a cellar. And that miniature chair by the door, with an identical twin fallen on its back near the opposite wall, belonged in a child's room. Standing by the shuttered window, a tall bookcase seemed proper enough, if only those cracked pots, bent boots, and other paraphernalia foreign to bookcases had not been stuffed among its battered volumes. A large bedroom bureau stood against one wall, but that would have seemed misplaced in any room. The hollows of its absent drawers were deeply webbed with disuse. All of these things seemed to me racked with the history of degeneration and death chronicled in our memory of the Van Leeuwens. But let that rest for now, lest I forget to tell of the thick, dreamy smell that permeated that room, inspiring the sense that malodorous gardens of misshapen growths were budding in the dust and dirty corners everywhere around me. The only light in the house was provided by two lamps that burned on either side of a mantel over the fireplace. Behind each of these lamps was an oval mirror in an ornate frame, and the reflected light of their quivering wicks threw our shadows onto the wide, bare wall at our backs. And while the two of us were sitting still and silent, I saw those other two fidgeting upon the wall, as if wind-blown or perhaps undergoing some subtle torture.
"I have something for you to drink," he said. "I know how far it is to walk from the town." And I did not have to feign my thirst, good people, for it was such that I wanted to swallow the storm, which I could hear beyond the door and the walls, but could only see as a brilliance occasionally flashing behind the curtains or shining needle-bright between the dull slats of the shutters. In the absence of my host, I directed my eyes to the treasures of his house and made them my own. But there was something I had not yet seen. Somehow I felt this. Then again, I was sent to spy, and so everything around me appeared suspicious. Can you see now what I failed to see then? Can you see it coming into focus through my eyes? Can you peek into those cobwebbed corners or scan the titles of those tilting books? Yes. But can you now, in the maddest dream of your lives, peer into places that have no corners and bear no names? This is what I try to do, to see beyond the ghoulish remnants of the Van Livens, to see beyond the haunted stage upon which I had made my entrance. And so I had to turn corners inside out with my eyes, and to read the third side of a book's page, seeking in futility to gaze at what I could then touch with none of my senses. It remained something shapeless and nameless, dampish and submerged, something swampy and abysmal which opposed the pure cold of the autumn storm outside. When my host returned, he carried with him a dusty green bottle and a sparkling glass, both of which he set upon that little table between our chairs. I took up the bottle, and it felt warm in my hand. Expecting some thickish, dark liquid to gush from the bottle's neck, I was surprised to see only the purest liquid flowing into the glass. I drank, and for a few moments was removed to a world of frozen light that lived within the cool and limpid water. In the meantime, the blank-faced man had placed something else upon the table. It was a small music box made of some dark wood which looked as if it had the hardness of a jewel and was florid with strange designs that were at once distinct and impossible to focalize. "I found this while rummaging about this place," the stranger said. Then slowly he drew back the cover of the box and sat back in his chair. I held both hands around that cold glass and listened to the still colder music. The crisp little notes that arose from the box were like stars of sound coming out in the twilight shadows and silence of the house. The storm had ended, leaving the world outside muffled by wetness. Within those closed rooms, which might now have been transported to the brink of a chasm or deep inside the earth, the music glimmered like infinitesimal flakes of light in that barren decor of dead days. Neither of us appeared to be breathing, and even the shadows behind our chairs were charmed with enchanted immobility. Everything held for a moment to allow the wandering music from the box to pass on toward some sublimely terrible destination. I tried to follow it through the yellowish haze of the room and deep into the darkness that pressed against the walls and then deeper into the darkness between the walls. Then through the walls and into the unbordered spaces where those silvery tones ascended and quivered like a swarm of insects. There was still beauty in this vision, however tinged it was with the sinister. Even at that point, I felt I could lose myself in the vastness spreading about me, a tenebrous expanse rich with unknown exploits. But then something began stirring, erupting like a disease, poking its horribly colored head through the cool blackness and chasing me back to my body. "So, what did you think? It was getting bad toward the end, wasn't it? I closed the box before it got worse. Would you say I was correct in my action?" "Yes," I said, my voice trembling. "I could see it on your face. My purpose wasn't to harm you. I just wanted to show you something, to give you a glimpse." I drank the rest of the water, then set the glass I was still holding on the table. Settling down a bit, I said, "And what was it that you showed me?" "The madness of things," he said. And he pronounced these words calmly, precisely, while staring into my eyes to see how I would react. Of course, I had to hear more. After all, that was why I was there, was it not?
Can you hear me in your dreams, my friends?
The madness of things, I reiterated, trying to draw more from him.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Nor do I. But that is all I can say about it. Those are the only words I can use. The only ones that apply. Once I delighted in them. As a young student in philosophy, I used to say to myself, I am going to learn the madness of things. This was something I felt I needed to know, that I needed to confront. If I could face the madness of things, I thought, then I would have nothing more to fear. I could live in the universe without feeling I was coming apart, without feeling I would explode with the madness of things that, to my mind, formed the very foundation of existence. I wanted to tear off the veil and see things as they are, not to blind myself to them.
And did you succeed? I asked, not caring in the least if I were listening to a lunatic. So fascinated was I by what he had to say. Though I could hardly grasp his words, I knew there was something in them that was not alien to me, and for some moments I was distracted by their implications. For who among us has not experienced something that could be called the madness of things? Even if we do not use those exact words, we must at some time in our lives have had a sense of their meaning. We must have touched or been touched by that derangement which the stranger thought to be the foundation of existence. If nothing else, my good people, we have all known the fate of the Van Livens. It would not be unusual if we pondered in the solitude of our minds what we call their tragedy, and wondered at this world of ours.
Succeeded, said the stranger, bringing me back to myself.
Oh, yes, only too well, I would say. I succeeded in tearing myself loose from all my fears, and even from the world itself. Now I am a vagabond of the universe, a drifter among spaces where the madness of things has no limits. One day, after years of study and practice, I gave myself over to whatever awaited me. But I cannot say where I go or why I go there. Everything is so much chaos in my existence. Somehow, though, I always come back to this world as if I were some creature that returns on occasion to its home ground. These places at which I arrive seem to draw me to them, as if they have been prepared, even invaded before me. For there are always things, little items, that are just what I would expect. That music box, for instance, I looked around until I found something of that sort. By its designs, I could see it had been touched by the madness of things, and so could you, I noticed. What havoc it must have caused for those unready for such phenomena. What happened in this house? I can only wonder. And so the tragedy of the Van Livens was illuminated. Which of them had come across the music box, where it must have lain hidden for who knows how long? Over time, they must have all become its victims. The condition of the house and its grounds, that was the first sign. And then the shouting we began to hear from inside that made us stay away. What did it all mean? It was almost a year before there were no longer any sounds or any movement behind the shutters of the house. Soon after, the 5 bodies were found. Some of them dead longer than others, none of them whole, all of them savaged beyond what was human. We wanted to think it was a stranger, but could not do so for long. not after an inspection was conducted and the conclusion drawn that they had gone after one another over at least a month's time. They said that old man Van Leeuwen must have been the last of them. His body was a mess of hacked pieces, but he must have done it himself, judging by the axe that was still gripped in his dead hand. "Excuse me," said the stranger, once again arousing me from a state of distraction. He was now standing by the shuttered window, peering through a row of slats he had pulled open. With a slow movement of his hand, he beckoned me to join him, surreptitiously, it seemed. "Look, can you see them?" Through the slats of the shuttered window, I could see something outside, just where the Van Leeuwens had once cultivated their much-admired garden in bygone days. But what I saw was like the designs on the music box, intricate yet indistinct. "They almost look like flowers, don't they? So brightly colored as they shine in the night. And yet, when I first came upon them, not in this body, of course, almost everything was dark. But it wasn't dark as a house is sometimes dark, or as the woods are dark because of thick trees keeping out the light. It was dark only because there was nothing to keep out the darkness. How do I know this? I know because I could see with more than my eyes. I could see with the darkness itself. With the darkness, I saw the darkness. It was immensity without end around me. Unbroken expansion, dark horizon meeting dark horizon. And there were also things within the darkness, and I believe within my own form, so that if I reached out to touch them across a universe of darkness, I also reached deep inside of myself, such as I was. Yet all I could feel were those things, the flowers. To touch them was like touching light and colors and a thousand kinds of bristling and growing shapes. In all that darkness which let me see with itself, these things squirmed, a wormy mass that was trying to make itself part of me. I must have brought them here when I came to this place. After I took this shape, they abandoned me and burrowed into that ground over there. They broke through the earth that same night, and I thought they would come after me. But somehow the situation had changed. I think they like being where they are now. You can see yourself how they twist about, almost happily." After these words, he fell silent for a moment. It was a dark night, the skies still blanketed by the clouds that earlier had brought the rain. The lamps upon the mantel shone with a piercing light that cut shadows out of the cloth of blackness around us. Why, good people, was I so astonished that this phantom before me could walk across the room and actually lift one of the lamps, then carry it toward the back hallway of the house? He paused, turned, and gestured for me to follow. "Now you will see them better for the darkness. That is, if you would see the true madness." "Oh, my friends, please do not despise me for the choice I made this night. Remember, it was you who sent me, for I was the one who belonged least to our town." Quietly, we walked from the house, as if we were two children sneaking away for a night in the woods. The lamplight skimmed across the wet grass behind the house and then paused where the yard ended and the woods began, fragrant and wind-blown. The light moved to the left, and I moved with it, toward that area where a garden once grew. "Look at them, wriggling in the light," he said, when the first rays fell on a convulsing tangle of shapes, like the radiant entrails of hell. But the shapes quickly disappeared into the darkness and out of view, pulling themselves from the rain-softened soil.
"They retreat from this light, and you see how they return to their places when the light is withdrawn."
They closed in again, like parted waters, rushing to reemerge. But these were corrupt waters, whose currents had congealed and diversified into creaturely forms, strung with sticky and pumping veins, hung with working mouths. "Move the light as close as you can to the garden," I said. He stepped to the very edge, as I stepped farther still toward that retreating flood of slimy tendrils, those aberrations of the abyss. When I was deep into their mesh, I whispered behind me, "Don't lose the light, or they will cover again the ground I am standing on. I can see them so well. The true madness. I have confronted it without fear."
"No," said the stranger, "you are not prepared. Come back to the light before the candle blows out." But I did not listen to him, or to the wind that rose up. It came down from the trees and swept across the garden, throwing it into darkness. And the wind now carries my words to you, good people.
I cannot be there to guide you, but you know now what must be done, both to this horrible house and to its garden that was brought into this world by one who doomed himself to wander other worlds. Please, one last word to stir your sleep. I remember screaming to the stranger, "They are drawing me into themselves. My eyes can see everything in the darkness. I am not who I am. Can you hear me? Can you hear my words?"
"I just had the most terrible dream,"
whispered one of the many who were awakening in the dark bedrooms of the town.
"It was not a dream. Can you hear the others outside?"
A nightgowned figure rose from the bed and moved as a silhouette to the window. Down in the street was a crowd, carrying lights and rapping on doors for those still dreaming to join them. Their lamps and lanterns bobbed in the darkness, and the fires of their torches flickered madly. Clusters of flame shot up into the night. The people of the town said not a word to one another, but they knew where they were going and what they would do to free their fellow citizen, my own self, from his tragedy. And though their eyes saw nothing but the wild destruction that lay ahead, buried like a forgotten dream, within each one of them was a perfect picture of other eyes and of the unspeakable shapes in which they were now embedded. "But do not let your fires burn out while you go about your work. Do not let them take you too into their unearthly realm.
Come then and close my eyes. Murder the beings into which they have been drawn. Then shutter your minds as well as you can to the abyss that is home to the madness of things."